Chapter 4. Back to the Burrow. By 12 o'clock next day, Harry's trunk was packed with his school things, and all his most prized possessions. The invisibility cloak he had inherited from his father, the broomstick he had got from Sirius, the enchanted map of Hogwarts he had been given by Fred and George Weasley last year. He had emptied his hiding-place under the loose floorboard of all food, double-checked every nook and cranny of his bedroom for forgotten spell-books or quills, and taken down the chart on the wall, counting the days down to September the 1st, on which he liked to cross off the days remaining until his return to Hogwarts. The atmosphere inside No. 4 Privet Drive was extremely tense. The imminent arrival at their house of an assortment of wizards was making the Dursleys uptight and irritable. Uncle Vernon had looked downright alarmed when Harry informed him that the Weasleys would be arriving at 5 o'clock the very next day.
"I hope you told them to dress properly, these people," he snarled at once. "I've seen the sort of stuff your lot wear. They'd better have the decency to put on normal clothes, that's all."
Harry felt a slight sense of foreboding. He had rarely seen Mr. or Mrs. Weasley wearing anything that the Dursleys would call normal. Their children might don muggle clothing during the holidays, but Mr. and Mrs. Weasley usually wore long robes in varying states of shabbiness. Harry wasn't bothered about what the neighbours would think, but he was anxious about how rude the Dursleys might be to the Weasleys if they turned up looking like their worst idea of wizards. Uncle Vernon had put on his best suit. To some people, this might have looked like a gesture of welcome, but Harry knew it was because Uncle Vernon wanted to look impressive and intimidating. Dudley, on the other hand, looked somehow diminished. This was not because the diet was at last taking effect, but due to fright. Dudley had emerged from his last encounter with a fully grown wizard with a curly pig's tail poking out of the seat of his trousers, and Aunt Petunia and Uncle Vernon had had to pay for its removal at a private hospital in London. It wasn't altogether surprising, therefore, that Dudley kept running his hand nervously over his backside and walking sideways from room to room so as not to present the same target to the enemy. Lunch was an almost silent meal. Dudley didn't even protest at the food, cottage cheese and grated celery. Aunt Petunia wasn't eating anything at all. Her arms were folded, her lips were pursed, and she seemed to be chewing her tongue, as though biting back the furious diatribe she longed to throw at Harry.
"They'll be driving, of course," Uncle Vernon barked across the table.
Said Harry. He hadn't thought of that. How were the Weasleys going to pick him up? They didn't have a car any more. The old Ford Anglia they had once owned was currently running wild in the Forbidden Forest at Hogwarts. But Mr. Weasley had borrowed a Ministry of Magic car last year. Possibly he would do the same today.
"I think so," said Harry.
Uncle Vernon snorted into his moustache. Normally, Uncle Vernon would have asked what car Mr. Weasley drove. He tended to judge other men on how big and expensive their cars were. But Harry doubted whether Uncle Vernon would have taken to Mr. Weasley even if he drove a Ferrari. Harry spent most of the afternoon in his bedroom. He couldn't stand watching Aunt Petunia peer out through the net curtains every few seconds, as though there had been a warning about an escaped rhinoceros. Finally, at 4:45, Harry went back downstairs and into the living room. Aunt Petunia was compulsively straightening cushions. Uncle Vernon was pretending to read the paper, but his tiny eyes were not moving, and Harry was sure he was really listening with all his might for the sound of an approaching car. Dudley was crammed into an armchair, his porky hands beneath him clamped firmly around his bottom. Harry couldn't take the tension. He left the room and went and sat on the stairs in the hall, his eyes on his watch and his heart pumping fast from excitement and nerves. But 5 o'clock came and then went. Uncle Vernon, perspiring slightly in his suit, opened the front door, peered up and down the street, then withdrew his head quickly.
"They're late," he snarled at Harry.
"I know," said Harry. "Maybe, the traffic's bad or something."
10 past 5. Then 5:15. Harry was starting to feel anxious himself now. At 1:30, he heard Uncle Vernon and Aunt Petunia conversing in terse mutters in the living room.
"No consideration at all. We might have had an engagement."
"Maybe they think they'll get invited to dinner if they're late."
"Well, they most certainly won't be,"
said Uncle Vernon, and Harry heard him stand up and start pacing the living room.
"They'll take the boy and go. There'll be no hanging around. That's if they're coming at all. Probably mistaken the day. I dare say their kind don't set much store by punctuality. Either that or they drive some tinpot car that's broken down."
Harry jumped up. From the other side of the living room door came the sounds of the three Dursleys scrambling, panic-stricken, across the room. Next moment, Dudley came flying into the hall, looking terrified.
"What happened?" said Harry. "What's the matter?"
But Dudley didn't seem able to speak. Hands still clamped over his buttocks, he waddled as fast as he could into the kitchen. Harry hurried into the living room. Loud bangings and scrapings were coming from behind the Dursleys' boarded-up fireplace, which had a fake coal fire plugged in front of it.
"What is it?"
gasped Aunt Petunia, who had backed into the wall and was staring, terrified, towards the fire.
"What is it, Vernon?"
But they were left in doubt barely a second longer. Voices could be heard from inside the blocked fireplace.
"Ouch! Fred, no, go back, go back. There's been some kind of mistake. Tell George not to... Ouch! George, no, there's no room. Go back quickly and tell Ron.
Maybe Harry can hear us, Dad. Maybe he'll be able to let us out."
There was a loud hammering of fists on the boards behind the electric fire.
"Harry! Harry, can you hear us?"
The Dursleys rounded on Harry like a pair of angry wolverines.
"What is this?" growled Uncle Vernon. "What's going on?"
They've tried to get here by flu powder," said Harry, fighting a mad desire to laugh. "They can travel by fire, only you've blocked the fireplace. Hang on." He approached the fireplace and called through the boards.
"Mr. Weasley, can you hear me?"
The hammering stopped. Somebody inside the chimney piece said, "Shh."
"Mr. Weasley, it's Harry. The fireplace has been blocked up. You won't be able to get through there."
"Damn," said Mr. Weasley's voice. "What on earth did they want to block up the fireplace for?"
"They've got an electric fire," Harry explained.
"Really?"
said Mr. Weasley's voice excitedly.
"Eclectic, you say? With a plug? Gracious, I must see that. Let's think. Ouch, Ron!"
Ron's voice now joined the others.
"What are we doing here? Has something gone wrong?"
"Oh, no, Ron," came Fred's voice, very sarcastically. "No, this is exactly where we wanted to end up."
"Yeah, we're having the time of our lives here,"
said George, whose voice sounded muffled, as though he was squashed against the wall.
"Boys, boys," said Mr. Weasley, vaguely. "I'm trying to think what to do. Yes, only way. Stand back, Harry!"
Harry retreated to the sofa. Uncle Vernon, however, moved forwards.
"Wait a moment!"
he bellowed at the fire.
"What exactly are you going to..." Bang!
The electric fire shot across the room as the boarded-up fireplace burst outwards, expelling Mr. Weasley, Fred, George and Ron in a cloud of rubble and loose chippings. Aunt Petunia shrieked and fell backwards over the coffee table. Uncle Vernon caught her before she hit the floor and gaped, speechless, at the Weasleys, all of whom had bright red hair, including Fred and George, who were identical to the last freckle.
"It's better," panted Mr. Weasley, brushing dust from his long green robes and straightening his glasses. "Ah, you must be Harry's aunt and uncle."
Tall, thin and balding, he moved towards Uncle Vernon, his hand outstretched. But Uncle Vernon backed away several paces, dragging Aunt Petunia. Words utterly failed Uncle Vernon. His best suit was covered in white dust, which had settled in his hair and moustache, and made him look as though he had just aged 30 years. Yes, sorry about that, said Mr. Weasley, lowering his hand and looking over his shoulder at the blasted fireplace. It's all my fault. It just didn't occur to me that we wouldn't be able to get out at the other end. I had your fireplace connected to the flue network, you see, just for an afternoon, you know, so we could get Harry. Muggle fireplaces aren't supposed to be connected, strictly speaking, but I got a useful contact at the flue regulation panel, and he fixed it for me. I can put it right in a jiffy, though. Don't worry. I'll light a fire to send the boys back, and then I can repair your fireplace before I disapparate. Harry was ready to bet that the Dursleys hadn't understood a single word of this. They were still gaping at Mr. Weasley, thunderstruck. Aunt Petunia staggered upright again and hid behind Uncle Vernon.
"Hello, Harry," said Mr. Weasley, brightly. "Got your trunk ready?"
"It's upstairs," said Harry, grinning back.
"We'll get it,"
said Fred at once. Winking at Harry, he and George left the room. They knew where Harry's bedroom was, having once rescued him from it in the dead of night. Harry suspected that Fred and George were hoping for a glimpse of Dudley. They had heard a lot about him from Harry.
"Well,"
said Mr. Weasley, swinging his arms slightly, while he tried to find words to break the very nasty silence.
Very nice place you've got here."
As the usually spotless living room was now covered in dust and bits of brick, this remark didn't go down too well with the Dursleys. Uncle Vernon's face purpled once more, and Aunt Petunia started chewing her tongue again. However, they seemed too scared to actually say anything. Mr. Weasley was looking around. He loved everything to do with muggles. Harry could see him itching to go and examine the television and the video recorder.
"They run off electricity, do they?" he said knowledgeably. "Ah, yes, I can see the plugs. I collect plugs," he added to Uncle Vernon, "and batteries. Got a very large collection of batteries. My wife thinks I'm mad, but there you are."
Uncle Vernon clearly thought Mr. Weasley was mad too. He moved ever so slightly to the right, screening Aunt Petunia from view, as though he thought Mr. Weasley might suddenly run at them and attack. Dudley suddenly reappeared in the room. Harry could hear the clunk of his trunk on the stairs, and knew that the sounds had scared Dudley out of the kitchen. Dudley edged along the wall, gazing at Mr. Weasley with terrified eyes, and attempted to conceal himself behind his mother and father. Unfortunately, Uncle Vernon's bulk, while sufficient to hide bony Aunt Petunia, was nowhere near enough to conceal Dudley.
"Ah, this is your cousin, is it, Harry?"
said Mr. Weasley, taking another brave stab at making conversation.
"Yep," said Harry, "that's Dudley."
He and Ron exchanged glances, and then quickly looked away from each other. The temptation to burst out laughing was almost overwhelming. Dudley was still clutching his bottom as though afraid it might fall off. Mr. Weasley, however, seemed genuinely concerned at Dudley's peculiar behaviour. Indeed, from the tone of his voice when he next spoke, Harry was quite sure that Mr. Weasley thought Dudley was quite as mad as the Dursleys thought he was, except that Mr. Weasley felt sympathy rather than fear.
"Having a good holiday, Dudley?"
he said kindly. Dudley whimpered. Harry saw his hands tighten still harder over his massive backside. Fred and George came back into the room, carrying Harry's school trunk. They glanced around as they entered and spotted Dudley. Their faces cracked into identical evil grins.
"Ah, right," said Mr. Weasley. "Better get cracking, then."
He pushed up the sleeves of his robes and took out his wand. Harry saw the Dursleys draw back against the wall as one.
"Incendio,"
said Mr. Weasley, pointing his wand at the hole in the wall behind him. Flames rose at once in the fireplace, crackling merrily as though they had been burning for hours. Mr. Weasley took a small drawstring bag from his pocket, untied it, took a pinch of the powder inside, and threw it onto the flames, which turned emerald green and roared higher than ever.
"Off you go then, Fred," said Mr. Weasley.
"Coming," said Fred.
"Oh, no, hang on."
A bag of sweets had spilled out of Fred's pocket, and the contents were now rolling in every direction, big, fat toffees in brightly coloured wrappers. Fred scrambled around, cramming them back into his pocket, then gave the Dursleys a cheery wave, stepped forward, and walked right into the fire, saying, "The burrow!" Aunt Petunia gave a little shuddering gasp. There was a whooshing sound, and Fred vanished.
"Right then, George," said Mr. Weasley, "you and the trunk."
Harry helped George carry the trunk forward into the flames and turn it onto its end so that he could hold it better. Then, with a second whoosh, George had cried, "The burrow!" and vanished too.
"Ron, you next," said Mr. Weasley.
"See you," said Ron brightly to the Dursleys. He grinned broadly at Harry, then stepped into the fire, shouted, "The burrow!" and disappeared. Now Harry and Mr. Weasley alone remained.
"Well, bye then,"
Harry said to the Dursleys. They didn't say anything at all. Harry moved towards the fire, but just as he reached the edge of the hearth, Mr. Weasley put out a hand and held him back. He was looking at the Dursleys in amazement.
"Harry said goodbye to you," he said. "Didn't you hear him?"
"It doesn't matter," Harry muttered to Mr. Weasley. "Honestly, I don't care." Mr. Weasley did not remove his hand from Harry's shoulder.
"You aren't going to see your nephew till next summer," he said to Uncle Vernon in mild indignation. "Surely you're going to say goodbye."
Uncle Vernon's face worked furiously. The idea of being taught consideration by a man who had just blasted away half his living-room wall seemed to be causing him intense suffering. But Mr. Weasley's wand was still in his hand, and Uncle Vernon's tiny eyes darted to it once before he said, very resentfully,
"Goodbye, then."
"See you," said Harry, putting one foot forward into the green flames, which felt pleasantly like warm breath. At that moment, however, a horrible gagging sound erupted behind him, and Aunt Petunia started to scream. Harry wheeled around. Dudley was no longer standing behind his parents. He was kneeling beside the coffee table, and he was gagging and spluttering on a foot-long, purple, slimy thing that was protruding from his mouth. One bewildered second later, Harry realized that the foot-long thing was Dudley's tongue, and that a brightly coloured toffee wrapper lay on the floor before him. Aunt Petunia hurled herself onto the ground beside Dudley, seized the end of his swollen tongue, and attempted to wrench it out of his mouth. Unsurprisingly, Dudley yelled and spluttered worse than ever, trying to fight her off. Uncle Vernon was bellowing and waving his arms around, and Mr. Weasley had to shout to make himself heard.
"Not to worry, I can sort him out,"
he yelled, advancing on Dudley with his wand outstretched. But Aunt Petunia screamed worse than ever and threw herself on top of Dudley, shielding him from Mr. Weasley.
"No, really," said Mr. Weasley desperately. "It's a simple process. It was the toffee, my son Fred, real practical joker, but it's only an engorgement charm. At least I think it is. Please, I can correct it."
But far from being reassured, the Dursleys became more panic-stricken. Aunt Petunia was sobbing hysterically, tugging Dudley's tongue, as though determined to rip it out. Dudley appeared to be suffocating under the combined pressure of his mother and his tongue, and Uncle Vernon, who had lost control completely, seized a china figure from on top of the sideboard and threw it very hard at Mr. Weasley, who ducked, causing the ornament to shatter in the blasted fireplace.
"Now, really," said Mr. Weasley angrily, brandishing his wand, "I'm trying to help."
Bellowing like a wounded hippo, Uncle Vernon snatched up another ornament.
"Harry, go, just go," Mr. Weasley shouted, his wand on Uncle Vernon. "I'll sort this out."
Harry didn't want to miss the fun, but Uncle Vernon's second ornament narrowly missed his left ear, and on balance he thought it best to leave the situation to Mr. Weasley. He stepped into the fire, looking over his shoulder as he said, "The burrow." His last fleeting glimpse of the living room was of Mr. Weasley blasting a third ornament out of Uncle Vernon's hand with his wand. Aunt Petunia screaming and lying on top of Dudley, and Dudley's tongue lolling around like a great slimy python. But next moment, Harry had begun to spin very fast, and the Dursleys' living room was whipped out of sight in a rush of emerald green flames. Chapter 5 Weasley's Wizard Wheezes. Harry spun faster and faster, elbows tucked tightly to his sides, blurred fireplaces flashing past him, until he started to feel sick and closed his eyes. Then, when at last he felt himself slowing down, he threw out his hands and brought himself to a halt in time to prevent himself falling face forwards out of the Weasleys' kitchen fire. "Did he eat it?" said Fred excitedly, holding out a hand to pull Harry to his feet. "Yeah," said Harry, straightening up. "What was it?" "Tongue-tongue-toffee," said Fred brightly. "George and I invented them. We've been looking for someone to test them on all summer." The tiny kitchen exploded with laughter. Harry looked around and saw that Ron and George were sitting at the scrubbed wooden table with two red-haired people Harry had never seen before, though he knew immediately who they must be, Bill and Charlie, the two eldest Weasley brothers. "How are you doing, Harry?" said the nearer of the two, grinning at him and holding out a large hand, which Harry shook, feeling calluses and blisters under his fingers. This had to be Charlie, who worked with dragons in Romania. Charlie was built like the twins, shorter and stockier than Percy and Ron, who were both long and lanky. He had a broad, good-natured face, which was weather-beaten and so freckly that he looked almost tanned. His arms were muscly, and one of them had a large, shiny burn on it. Bill got to his feet, smiling, and also shook Harry's hand. Bill came as something of a surprise. Harry knew that he worked for the Wizarding Bank, Gringotts, that he had been head boy of Hogwarts, and had always imagined Bill to be an older version of Percy, fussy about rule-breaking and fond of bossing everyone around. However, Bill was, there was no other word for it, cool. He was tall, with long hair that he had tied back in a ponytail. He was wearing an earring with what looked like a fang dangling from it. His clothes would not have looked out of place at a rock concert, except that Harry recognised his boots to be made not of leather, but of dragon hide. Before any of them could say anything else, there was a faint popping noise, and Mr. Weasley appeared out of thin air at George's shoulder. He was looking angrier than Harry had ever seen him.
"That wasn't funny, Fred!" he shouted. "What on earth did you give that muggle boy?"
"I didn't give him anything," said Fred, with another evil grin. "I just dropped it. It was his fault he went and ate it. I never told him to."
"You dropped it on purpose!" roared Mr. Weasley. "You knew he'd eat it. You knew he was on a diet." "How big did his tongue get?" George asked eagerly. "It was 4 foot long before his parents would let me shrink it."
Harry and the Weasleys roared with laughter again.
"It isn't funny!" Mr. Weasley shouted. "That sort of behaviour seriously undermines wizard-muggle relations. I spend half my life campaigning against the mistreatment of muggles and my own sons."
"We didn't give it to him because he was a muggle," said Fred indignantly.
"No, we gave it to him because he's a great bullying git," said George. "Isn't he, Harry?"
"Yeah, he is, Mr. Weasley," said Harry earnestly.
"That's not the point," raged Mr. Weasley. "You wait until I tell your mother!"
"Tell me what?" said a voice behind them. Mrs. Weasley had just entered the kitchen. She was a short, plump woman with a very kind face, though her eyes were presently narrowed with suspicion.
"Oh, hello, Harry, dear," she said, spotting him and smiling.
Then her eyes snapped back to her husband.
"Tell me what, Arthur?"
Mr. Weasley hesitated. Harry could tell that, however angry he was with Fred and George, he hadn't really intended to tell Mrs. Weasley what had happened. There was a silence while Mr. Weasley eyed his wife nervously.
Then two girls appeared in the kitchen doorway behind Mrs. Weasley. One, with very bushy brown hair and rather large front teeth, was Harry and Ron's friend Hermione Granger. The other, who was small and red-haired, was Ron's younger sister, Ginny. Both of them smiled at Harry, who grinned back, which made Ginny go scarlet. She had been very taken with Harry ever since his first visit to the Burrow. "Tell me what, Arthur?" Mrs. Weasley repeated in a dangerous sort of voice.
"It's nothing, Molly," mumbled Mr. Weasley. "Fred and George just—but I've had words with them."
"What have they done this time?" said Mrs. Weasley. "If it's got anything to do with Weasley's wizard wheezes—"
"Why don't you show Harry where he's sleeping, Ron?" said Hermione from the doorway.
"He knows where he's sleeping," said Ron. "In my room. He slept there last—"
"We can all go," said Hermione pointedly.
"Oh!" said Ron, cottoning on. "Right!"
"Yeah, we'll come too," said George.
"You stay where you are!" snarled Mrs. Weasley.
Harry and Ron edged out of the kitchen, and they, Hermione and Ginny, set off along the narrow hallway and up the rickety staircase that zigzagged through the house to the upper stories.
"What are Weasley's wizard wheezes?" Harry asked as they climbed.
Ron and Ginny both laughed, although Hermione didn't.
"Mum found this stack of order forms when she was cleaning Fred and George's room," said Ron quietly. "Great long price lists for stuff they've invented. Joke stuff, you know, fake wands and trick sweets, loads of stuff. It was brilliant. I never knew they'd been inventing all that."
"We've been hearing explosions out of their room for ages, but we never thought they were actually making things," said Ginny. "We thought they just liked the noise."
"Only most of the stuff, well, all of it really, was a bit dangerous," said Ron. "And, you know, they were planning to sell it at Hogwarts to make some money. And Mum went mad at them, told them they weren't allowed to make any more of it, and burnt all the order forms. She's furious at them anyway. They didn't get as many OWLs as she expected."
OWLs were ordinary wizarding levels, the examinations Hogwarts students took at the age of 15.
"And then there was this big row," Ginny said, "because Mum wants them to go into the Ministry of Magic like Dad, and they told her all they want to do is open a joke shop."
Just then, a door on the second landing opened, and a face poked out wearing horn-rimmed glasses and a very annoyed expression.
"Hi, Percy," said Harry.
"Oh, hello, Harry," said Percy. "I was wondering who was making all the noise. I'm trying to work in here, you know. I've got a report to finish for the office, and it's rather difficult to concentrate when people keep thundering up and down the stairs."
"We're not thundering," said Ron irritably. "We're walking. Sorry if we've disturbed the top-secret workings of the Ministry of Magic."
"What are you working on?" said Harry.
"A report for the Department of International Magical Cooperation," said Percy smugly. "We are trying to standardise cauldron thickness. Some of these foreign imports are just a shade too thin. Leakages have been increasing at a rate of almost 3% a year."
"Oh, that'll change the world, that report will," said Ron. "Front page of the Daily Prophet, I expect. Cauldron leaks."
Percy went slightly pink.
"You might sneer, Ron," he said heatedly, "but unless some sort of international law is imposed, we might well find the market flooded with flimsy, shallow-bottomed products which seriously endanger—"
"Yeah, yeah, all right," said Ron, and he started off upstairs again.
Percy slammed his bedroom door shut. As Harry, Hermione and Ginny followed Ron up three more flights of stairs, shouts from the kitchen below echoed up to them. It sounded as though Mr. Weasley had told Mrs. Weasley about the toffees. The room at the top of the house where Ron slept looked much as it had done the last time that Harry had come to stay. The same posters of Ron's favourite Quidditch team, the Chudley Cannons, were whirling and waving on the walls and sloping ceiling, and the fish tank on the windowsill, which had previously held frog spawn, now contained one extremely large frog. Ron's old rat, Scabbers, was here no more, but instead there was the tiny grey owl that had delivered Ron's letter to Harry in Privet Drive. It was hopping up and down in a small cage and twittering madly.
"Shut up, pig," said Ron, edging his way between two of the four beds that had been squeezed into the room.
Fred and George are in here with us because Bill and Charlie are in their room, he told Harry. Percy gets to keep his room all to himself because he's got to work.
Why are you calling that owl Pig? Harry asked Ron.
Because he's being stupid, said Ginny. Its proper name is Pigwidgeon.
Yeah, and that's not a stupid name at all, said Ron sarcastically. Ginny named him, he explained to Harry. She reckons it's sweet. And I tried to change it, but it was too late. He won't answer to anything else. So now he's Pig. I've got to keep him up here because he annoys Errol and Hermes. He annoys me, too, come to that. Pigwidgeon zoomed happily around his cage, hooting shrilly. Harry knew Ron too well to take him seriously. He had moaned continually about his old rat Scabbers, but had been most upset when Hermione's cat, Crookshanks, appeared to have eaten him.
"Where's Crookshanks?" Harry asked Hermione now.
"Out in the garden, I expect," she said. "He likes chasing gnomes. He's never seen any before."
"Percy's enjoying work, then," said Harry,
sitting down on one of the beds and watching the Chudley cannons zooming in and out of the posters on the ceiling.
"Enjoying it?" said Ron darkly. "I don't reckon he'd come home if Dad didn't make him. He's obsessed. Just don't get him onto the subject of his boss. According to Mr. Crouch, as I was saying to Mr. Crouch, Mr. Crouch is of the opinion. Mr. Crouch was telling me. They'll be announcing their engagement any day now."
"Have you had a good summer, Harry?" said Hermione. "Did you get our food parcels and everything?"
"Yeah, thanks a lot," said Harry. "They saved my life, those cakes."
"And have you heard from—"
Ron began, but at a look from Hermione he fell silent. Harry knew Ron had been about to ask about Sirius. Ron and Hermione had been so deeply involved in helping Sirius escape from the Ministry of Magic that they were almost as concerned about Harry's godfather as he was. However, discussing him in front of Ginny was a bad idea. Nobody but themselves and Professor Dumbledore knew about how Sirius had escaped, or believed in his innocence.
"I think they've stopped arguing," said Hermione, to cover the awkward moment, because Ginny was looking curiously from Ron to Harry. "Shall we go down and help your mum with dinner?"
"Yeah, all right," said Ron.
The four of them left Ron's room and went back downstairs to find Mrs. Weasley alone in the kitchen looking extremely bad-tempered.
"We're eating out in the garden," she said when they came in. "There's just not room for 11 people in here. Could you take the plates outside, girls? Bill and Charlie are setting up the tables. Knives and forks, please, you two," she said to Ron and Harry, pointing her wand a little more vigorously than she had intended at a pile of potatoes in the sink, which shot out of their skins so fast that they ricocheted off the walls and ceilings.
"Oh, for heaven's sake!" she snapped, now directing her wand at a dustpan, which hopped off the side and started skating across the floor, scooping up the potatoes.
"Those two!" she burst out savagely, now pulling pots and pans out of a cupboard, and Harry knew she meant Fred and George. "I don't know what's going to happen to them. I really don't. No ambition, unless you count making as much trouble as they possibly can."
She slammed a large copper saucepan down on the kitchen table and began to wave her wand around inside it. A creamy sauce poured from the wand tip as she stirred.
"It's not as though they haven't got brains," she continued irritably, taking the saucepan over to the stove and lighting it with a further poke of her wand. "But they're wasting them, and unless they pull themselves together soon, they'll be in real trouble. I've had more owls from Hogwarts about them than the rest put together. If they carry on the way they're going, they'll end up in front of the Improper Use of Magic office."
Mrs. Weasley jabbed her wand at the cutlery drawer, which shot open. Harry and Ron both jumped out of the way as several knives soared out of it, flew across the kitchen, and began chopping the potatoes, which had just been tipped back into the sink by the dustpan.
"I don't know where we went wrong with them," said Mrs. Weasley, putting down her wand and starting to pull out still more saucepans. "It's been the same for years, one thing after another, and they won't listen to—" "Oh, not again!"
She had picked up her wand from the table, and it had emitted a loud squeak and turned into a giant rubber mouse.
"One of their fake wands again!" she shouted. "How many times have I told those two not to leave them lying around?"
She grabbed her real wand and turned around to find that the sauce on the stove was smoking.
"Come on,
Ron said hurriedly to Harry, seizing a handful of cutlery from the open drawer. "Let's go and help Bill and Charlie." They left Mrs. Weasley and headed out of the back door into the yard. They had only gone a few paces when Hermione's bandy-legged ginger cat Crookshanks came pelting out of the garden, bottle-brush tail held high in the air, chasing what looked like a muddy potato on legs. Harry recognised it instantly as a gnome. Barely 10 inches high, its horny little feet pattered very fast as it sprinted across the yard and dived headlong into one of the Wellington boots that lay scattered around the door. Harry could hear the gnome giggling madly as Crookshanks inserted a paw into the boot, trying to reach it. Meanwhile, a very loud crashing noise was coming from the other side of the house. The source of the commotion was revealed as they entered the garden and saw that Bill and Charlie both had their wands out and were making two battered old tables fly high above the lawn, smashing into each other, each attempting to knock the others out of the air. Fred and George were cheering, Ginny was laughing, and Hermione was hovering near the hedge, apparently torn between amusement and anxiety. Bill's table caught Charlie's with a huge bang and knocked one of its legs off. There was a clatter from overhead, and they all looked up to see Percy's head poking out of a window on the second floor. "Will you keep it down?" he bellowed. "Sorry, Perce," said Bill, grinning. "How are the cauldron bottoms coming on?" "Very badly," said Percy peevishly, and he slammed the window shut again. Chuckling, Bill and Charlie directed the tables safely onto the grass, end to end, and then, with a flick of his wand, Bill reattached the table leg and conjured tablecloths from nowhere. By 7 o'clock, the two tables were groaning under dishes and dishes of Mrs. Weasley's excellent cooking, and the 9 Weasleys, Harry and Hermione, were settling themselves down to eat beneath a clear, deep blue sky. To somebody who had been living on meals of increasingly stale cake all summer, this was paradise. And at first Harry listened rather than talked as he helped himself to chicken and ham pie, boiled potatoes and salad. At the far end of the table, Percy was telling his father all about his report on cauldron bottoms. "I've told Mr. Crouch that I'll have it ready by Tuesday," Percy was saying pompously. "That's a bit sooner than he expected it, but I like to keep on top of things. I think he'll be grateful I've done it in good time. I mean, it's extremely busy in our department just now, what with all the arrangements for the World Cup. We're just not getting the support we need from the Department of Magical Games and Sports. Ludo Bagman." "I like Ludo," said Mr. Weasley mildly. "He was the one who got us such good tickets for the Cup. I did him a bit of a favour. His brother Otto got into a spot of trouble, a lawnmower with unnatural powers. I smoothed the whole thing over." "Oh, Bagman's likeable enough, of course," said Percy dismissively. "But how he ever got to be head of department, when I compare him to Mr. Crouch... I can't see Mr. Crouch losing a member of our department and not trying to find out what's happened to them. You realise Bertha Jorkins has been missing for over a month now, went on holiday to Albania and never came back." "Yes, I was asking Ludo about that," said Mr. Weasley, frowning. "He says Bertha's got lost plenty of times before now, though I must say if it was someone in my department I'd be worried." "Oh, Bertha's hopeless, all right," said Percy. "I hear she's been shunted from department to department for years, much more trouble than she's worth. But all the same, Bagman ought to be trying to find her. Mr. Crouch has been taking a personal interest. She worked in our department at one time, you know, and I think Mr. Crouch was quite fond of her. But Bagman just keeps laughing and saying she probably misread the map and ended up in Australia instead of Albania. However..." Percy heaved an impressive sigh and took a deep swig of elderflower wine. "We've got quite enough on our plates at the Department of International Magical Cooperation without trying to find members of other departments too. As you know, we've got another big event to organise right after the World Cup." He cleared his throat significantly and looked down towards the end of the table where Harry, Ron and Hermione were sitting. "You know the one I'm talking about, Father." He raised his voice slightly. "The top secret one." Ron rolled his eyes and muttered to Harry and Hermione.
He's been trying to get us to ask what that event is ever since he started work. Probably an exhibition of thick-bottomed cauldrons. In the middle of the table, Mrs. Weasley was arguing with Bill about his earring, which seemed to be a recent acquisition.
"With a horrible great fang on it. Really, Bill, what do they say at the bank?"
"Mum, no one at the bank gives a damn how I dress as long as I bring home plenty of treasure," said Bill patiently.
"And your hair's getting silly, dear," said Mrs. Weasley, fingering her wand lovingly. "I wish you'd let me give it a trim." "I like it," said Jinny, who was sitting beside Bill. "You're so old-fashioned, Mum. Anyway, it's nowhere near as long as Professor Dumbledore's."
Next to Mrs. Weasley, Fred, George and Charlie were all talking spiritedly about the World Cup.
"It's got to be Ireland," said Charlie thickly through a mouthful of potato. "They flattened Peru in the semi-finals."
"Bulgaria have got Victor Crumb, though," said Fred.
"Crumb's one decent player. Ireland have got seven," said Charlie shortly. "I wish England had got through, though. That was embarrassing, that was."
"What happened?"
said Harry eagerly, regretting more than ever his isolation from the wizarding world when he was stuck in Privet Drive. Harry was passionate about Quidditch. He had played as seeker on the Gryffindor House Quidditch team ever since his first year at Hogwarts and owned a Firebolt, one of the best racing brooms in the world.
"Went down to Transylvania, 390-10, said Charlie gloomily. "Shocking performance. And Wales lost to Uganda, and Scotland was slaughtered by Luxembourg."
Mr. Weasley conjured up candles to light the darkening garden before they had their pudding, homemade strawberry ice cream. And by the time they had finished, moths were fluttering low over the table, and the warm air was perfumed with the smells of grass and honeysuckle. Harry was feeling extremely well-fed and at peace with the world as he watched several gnomes sprinting through the rose bushes, laughing madly and closely pursued by Crookshanks. Ron looked carefully up the table to check that the rest of the family were all busy talking. Then he said very quietly to Harry,
"So, have you heard from Sirius lately?"
Hermione looked round, listening closely.
"Yeah," said Harry softly, "twice. He sounds okay. I wrote to him the day before yesterday. He might write back while I'm here."
He suddenly remembered the reason he had written to Sirius and, for a moment, was on the verge of telling Ron and Hermione about his scar hurting again and about the dream which had awoken him. But he really didn't want to worry them just now, not when he himself was feeling so happy and peaceful.
"Look at the time," Mrs. Weasley said suddenly, checking her wristwatch. "You really should be in bed, the whole lot of you. You'll be up at the crack of dawn to get to the cup. Harry, if you leave your school list out, I'll get your things for you tomorrow in Diagon Alley. I'm getting everyone else's. There might not be time after the World Cup. The match went on for 5 days last time."
"Wow, hope it does this time," said Harry enthusiastically.
"Well, I certainly don't," said Percy sanctimoniously. "I shudder to think what the state of my in-tray would be if I was away from work for 5 days.
"Yeah, someone might slip dragon dung in it again, eh, Perse?" said Fred.
"That was a sample of fertilizer from Norway," said Percy, going very red in the face. "It was nothing personal."
"It was," Fred whispered to Harry as they got up from the table. "We sent it."
Chapter 6. The Portkey. Harry felt as though he had barely lain down to sleep in Ron's room when he was being shaken awake by Mrs. Weasley.
"Time to go, Harry dear," she whispered, moving away to wake Ron.
Harry felt around for his glasses, put them on and sat up. It was still dark outside. Ron muttered indistinctly as his mother roused him. At the foot of Harry's mattress he saw two large, dishevelled shapes emerging from tangles of blankets.
"It's time already," said Fred groggily.
They dressed in silence, too sleepy to talk. Then, yawning and stretching, the four of them headed downstairs into the kitchen.
Mrs. Weasley was stirring the contents of a large pot on the stove, while Mr. Weasley was sitting at the table checking a sheaf of large parchment tickets. He looked up as the boys entered and spread his arms so they could see his clothes more clearly. He was wearing what appeared to be a golfing jumper and a very old pair of jeans, slightly too big for him, and held up with a thick leather belt. "What do you think?" he asked anxiously. "We're supposed to go incognito. Do I look like a muggle, Harry?"
"Yeah," said Harry, smiling. "Very good."
"Where are Bill and Charlie and Percy?" said George, failing to stifle a huge yawn.
"Well, they're apparating, aren't they?" said Mrs. Weasley, heaving the large pot over to the table and starting to ladle porridge into bowls. "So they can have a bit of a lie-in."
Harry knew that apparating was very difficult. It meant disappearing from one place and reappearing almost instantly in another.
"So they're still in bed," said Fred grumpily, pulling his bowl of porridge towards him. "Why can't we apparate too?"
"Because you're not of age and you haven't got your test," snapped Mrs. Weasley. "And where have those girls got to?"
She bustled out of the kitchen, and they heard her climbing the stairs.
"You have to pass a test to apparate?" Harry asked. "Oh, yes," said Mr. Weasley, tucking the tickets safely into the back pocket of his jeans. "The Department of Magical Transportation had to fine a couple of people the other day for apparating without a license. It's not easy, apparition, and when it's not done properly, it can lead to nasty complications. This pair I'm talking about went and splinched themselves."
Everyone around the table except Harry winced.
Splinched? Said Harry.
"They left half of themselves behind," said Mr. Weasley, now spooning large amounts of treacle onto his porridge.
"So, of course, they were stuck. Couldn't move either way. Had to wait for the accidental magic reversal squad to sort them out. Meant a fair old bit of paperwork, I can tell you, what with the muggles who spotted the body parts they'd left behind."
Harry had a sudden vision of a pair of legs and an eyeball lying abandoned on the pavement of Privet Drive.
"Were they okay?" he asked, startled.
"Oh, yes," said Mr. Weasley, matter-of-factly. "But they got a heavy fine, and I don't think they'll be trying it again in a hurry. You don't mess around with apparition. There are plenty of adult wizards who don't bother with it. Prefer brooms. Slower, but safer."
"But Bill and Charlie and Percy can all do it."
"Charlie had to take the test twice," said Fred, grinning. "He failed first time. Apparated 5 miles south of where he meant to, right on top of some poor old dear doing her shopping, remember?"
"Yes, well, he passed second time," said Mrs. Weasley, marching back into the kitchen amid hearty sniggers.
"Percy only passed 2 weeks ago," said George. "He's been apparating downstairs every morning since, just to prove he can."
There were footsteps down the passageway, and Hermione and Ginny came into the kitchen, both looking pale and drowsy.
"Why do we have to be up so early?"
Ginny said, rubbing her eyes and sitting down at the table.
"We've got a bit of a walk," said Mr. Weasley.
"Walk?" said Harry.
"What, are we walking to the World Cup?"
"No, no, that's miles away," said Mr. Weasley, smiling. "We only need to walk a short way. It's just that it's very difficult for a large number of wizards to congregate without attracting muggle attention. We have to be very careful about how we travel at the best of times, and on a huge occasion like the Quidditch World Cup."
"George!"
said Mrs. Weasley sharply, and they all jumped.
"What?" said George, in an innocent tone that deceived nobody.
"What is that in your pocket?"
"Nothing."
"Don't you lie to me!"
Mrs. Weasley pointed her wand at George's pocket and said,
"Axio!"
Several small, brightly coloured objects zoomed out of George's pocket. He made a grab for them, but missed, and they sped right into Mrs. Weasley's outstretched hand.
"We told you to destroy them!"
said Mrs. Weasley furiously, holding up what were unmistakably more Tun-Tung toffees.
"We told you to get rid of the lot! Empty your pockets! Go on, both of you!"
It was an unpleasant scene. The twins had evidently been trying to smuggle as many toffees out of the house as possible, and it was only by using her summoning charm that Mrs. Weasley managed to find them all.
"Axio! Axio! Axio!"
she shouted, and toffees zoomed from all sorts of unlikely places, including the lining of George's jacket and the turn-ups of Fred's jeans.
We spent 6 months developing those,
Fred shouted at his mother as she threw the toffees away.
Oh, a fine way to spend 6 months, she shrieked. No wonder you didn't get more OWLs.
All in all, the atmosphere was not very friendly as they made their departure. Mrs. Weasley was still glowering as she kissed Mr. Weasley on the cheek, though not nearly as much as the twins, who had each hoisted their rucksacks onto their backs and walked out without a word to her.
"Well, have a lovely time," said Mrs. Weasley. "And behave yourselves," she called after the twins' retreating backs, but they did not look back or answer. "I'll send Bill, Charlie and Percy along around midday," Mrs. Weasley said to Mr. Weasley, as he, Harry, Ron, Hermione and Ginny set off across the dark yard after Fred and George. It was chilly, and the moon was still out. Only a dull greenish tinge along the horizon to their right showed that daybreak was drawing closer. Harry, having been thinking about thousands of wizards speeding towards the Quidditch World Cup, sped up to walk with Mr. Weasley.
"So how does everyone get there without all the Muggles noticing?" he asked.
"It's been a massive organisational problem," sighed Mr. Weasley. "The trouble is, about 100,000 wizards turn up to the World Cup, and of course we just haven't got a magical site big enough to accommodate them all. There are places Muggles can't penetrate, but imagine trying to pack 100,000 wizards into Diagon Alley or Platform 9¾. So we had to find a nice deserted moor and set up as many anti-Muggle precautions as possible. The whole ministry's been working on it for months. Firstly, of course, we have to stagger the arrivals. People with cheaper tickets have to arrive 2 weeks beforehand. A limited number use Muggle transport, but we can't have too many clogging up their buses and trains. Remember, wizards are coming from all over the world. Some apparate, of course, but we have to set up safe points for them to appear, well away from Muggles. I believe there's a handy wood they're using as the apparition point. For those who don't want to apparate, or can't, we use port keys. They're objects that are used to transport wizards from one spot to another at a prearranged time. You can do large groups at a time if you need to. There have been 200 port keys placed at strategic points around Britain, and the nearest one to us is up the top of Stoat's Head Hill, so that's where we're headed."
Mr. Weasley pointed ahead of them, where a large black mass rose beyond the village of Otteris and Catchpole. "What sort of objects are port keys?" said Harry curiously.
"Well, they can be anything," said Mr. Weasley. "Unobtrusive things, obviously, so Muggles don't go picking them up and playing with them. Stuff they'll just think is litter."
They trudged down the dark, dank lane towards the village, the silence broken only by their footsteps. The sky lightened very slowly as they made their way through the village, its inky blackness diluting to deepest blue. Harry's hands and feet were freezing. Mr. Weasley kept checking his watch. They didn't have breath to spare for talking as they began to climb Stoat's Head Hill, stumbling occasionally in hidden rabbit holes, slipping on thick black tuffets of grass. Each breath Harry took was sharp in his chest, and his legs were starting to seize up when at last his feet found level ground.
"Phew!"
panted Mr. Weasley, taking off his glasses and wiping them on his sweater.
"Well, we've made good time. We've got 10 minutes.
Hermione came over the crest of the hill last, clutching a stitch in her side.
"Now we just need the port key,"
said Mr. Weasley, replacing his glasses and squinting around at the ground.
"It won't be big. Come on."
They spread out, searching. They had only been at it for a couple of minutes, however, when a shout rent the still air.
"Over here, Arthur! Over here, son! We've got it!"
Two tall figures were silhouetted against the starry sky on the other side of the hilltop.
"Amos," said Mr. Weasley,
smiling as he strode over to the man who had shouted. The rest of them followed. Mr. Weasley was shaking hands with a ruddy-faced wizard with a scrubby brown beard, who was holding a mouldy-looking old boot in his other hand.
"This is Amos Diggory, everyone," said Mr. Weasley. "Works for the Department for the Regulation and Control of Magical Creatures. And I think you know his son, Cedric."
Cedric Diggory was an extremely handsome boy of around 17. He was captain and seeker of the Hufflepuff House Quidditch team at Hogwarts.
"Hi," said Cedric, looking around at them all.
Everyone said hi back, except Fred and George, who merely nodded. They had never quite forgiven Cedric for beating their team Gryffindor in the first Quidditch match of the previous year.
"Long walk, Arthur?" Cedric's father asked.
"Not too bad," said Mr. Weasley. "We live just on the other side of the village there. You?"
"Had to get up at 2, didn't we, Ced? I tell you, I'll be glad when he's got his apparition test. Still, not complaining. Quidditch World Cup wouldn't miss it for a sackful of galleons, and the tickets cost about that. Mind you, looks like I got off easy."
Amos Diggory peered good-naturedly around at the three Weasley boys, Harry, Hermione and Ginny.
"All these yours, Arthur?"
"Oh, no, only the redheads," said Mr. Weasley, pointing out his children. "This is Hermione, friend of Ron's, and Harry, another friend."
"Merlin's beard," said Amos Diggory, his eyes widening. "Harry? Harry Potter?"
Yeah, said Harry. Harry was used to people looking curiously at him when they met him, used to the way their eyes moved at once to the lightning scar on his forehead, but it always made him feel uncomfortable.
"Sid's talked about you, of course," said Amos Diggory. "Told us all about playing against you last year. I said to him, I said, Sid, that'll be something to tell your grandchildren, that will. You beat Harry Potter!"
Harry couldn't think of any reply to this, so he remained silent. Fred and George were both scowling again. Cedric looked slightly embarrassed.
"Harry fell off his broom, Dad," he muttered. "I told you, it was an accident." "Yes, but you didn't fall off, did you?"
roared Amos genially, slapping his son on his back.
"Always modest, I said. Always the gentleman. But the best man won. I'm sure Harry'd say the same, wouldn't you, eh? One falls off his broom, one stays on. You don't need to be a genius to tell which one's the better flyer."
"Must be nearly time," said Mr. Weasley quickly, pulling out his watch again. "Do you know whether we're waiting for any more, Amos?"
"No, the Lovegoods have been there for a week already, and the Fawcetts couldn't get tickets," said Mr. Diggory. "There aren't any more of us in this area, are there?"
"Not that I know of," said Mr. Weasley. "Yes, it's a minute off. We'd better get ready."
He looked around at Harry and Hermione.
"You just need to touch the portkey, that's all. A finger will do."
With difficulty, owing to the bulky backpacks, the nine of them crowded around the old boot held out by Amos Diggory. They all stood there in a tight circle as a chill breeze swept over the hilltop. Nobody spoke. It suddenly occurred to Harry how odd this would look if a muggle were to walk up here now. 9 people, 2 grown men, clutching this manky old boot in the semi-darkness, waiting.
3, muttered Mr. Weasley, one eye still on his watch. 2, 1.
It happened immediately. Harry felt as though a hook just behind his navel had been suddenly jerked irresistibly forwards. His feet had left the ground. He could feel Ron and Hermione on either side of him, their shoulders banging into his. They were all speeding forwards in a howl of wind and swirling colour. His forefinger was stuck to the boot as though it was pulling him magnetically onwards, and then his feet slammed into the ground. Ron staggered into him and he fell over. The portkey hit the ground near his head with a heavy thud. Harry looked up. Mr. Weasley, Mr. Diggory, and Cedric were still standing, though looking very windswept. Everybody else was on the ground.
7 past 5 from Stoke's Head Hill, said a voice.
Chapter 7 Bagman and Crouch. Harry disentangled himself from Ron and got to his feet. They had arrived on what appeared to be a deserted stretch of misty moor. In front of them was a pair of tired and grumpy-looking wizards, one of whom was holding a large gold watch, the other a thick roll of parchment and a quill. Both were dressed as muggles, though very inexpertly. The man with the watch wore a tweed suit with thigh-length galoshes, his colleague a kilt and a poncho.
"Morning, Basil,"
said Mr. Weasley, picking up the boot and handing it to the kilted wizard, who threw it into a large box of used portkeys beside him. Harry could see an old newspaper, an empty drinks can, and a punctured football.
"Hello there, Arthur," said Basil wearily. "Not on duty, eh? It's all right for some. We've been here all night. You'd better get out of the way. We've got a big party coming in from the Black Forest at 5:15. Hang on, I'll find your campsite. Weasley, Weasley." He consulted his parchment list. "About a quarter of a mile's walk over there. First field you come to. Site manager's called Mr. Roberts. Diggory, second field. Ask for Mr. Payne." "Thanks, Basil," said Mr. Weasley, and he beckoned everyone to follow him. They set off across the deserted moor, unable to make out much through the mist. After about 20 minutes, a small stone cottage next to a gate swam into view. Beyond it, Harry could just make out the ghostly shapes of hundreds and hundreds of tents, rising up the gentle slope of a large field towards a dark wood on the horizon. They said goodbye to the Diggories and approached the cottage door. A man was standing in the doorway looking out at the tents. Harry knew at a glance that this was the only real Muggle for several acres. When he heard their footsteps, he turned his head to look at them. "Morning," said Mr. Weasley, brightly.
"Morning," said the Muggle.
"Would you be Mr. Roberts?"
"Aye, I would," said Mr. Roberts. "And who are you?"
"Weasley, two tents, booked a couple of days ago."
"Aye," said Mr. Roberts, consulting a list tacked to the door. "You've got a space up by the wood there. Just the one night?"
"That's it," said Mr. Weasley.
"You'll be paying now, then," said Mr. Roberts.
"Ah, right, certainly," said Mr. Weasley.
He retreated a short distance from the cottage and beckoned Harry towards him.
"Help me, Harry,"
he muttered, pulling a roll of Muggle money from his pocket and starting to peel the notes apart.
"This one's a 10? Ah, yes, I see the little number on it now. So this is a 5.
"A 20, Harry corrected him in an undertone, uncomfortably aware of Mr. Roberts trying to catch every word.
"Ah, yes, so it is. I don't know these little bits of paper."
"You foreign?"
said Mr. Roberts, as Mr. Weasley returned with the correct notes.
"Foreign?" repeated Mr. Weasley, puzzled.
"You're not the first one who's had trouble with money,"
said Mr. Roberts, scrutinising Mr. Weasley closely.
"I had 2 try and pay me with great gold coins the size of hubcaps 10 minutes ago."
"Did you really?"
said Mr. Weasley, nervously. Mr. Roberts rummaged around in a tin for some change.
"Never been this crowded," he said suddenly, looking out over the misty field again. "Hundreds of pre-bookings. People usually just turn up."
"Is that right?"
said Mr. Weasley, his hand held out for his change. But Mr. Roberts didn't give it to him.
"Aye," he said thoughtfully. "People from all over. Loads of foreigners. And not just foreigners. Weirdos, you know. There's a bloke walking round in a kilt and a poncho."
"Shouldn't he?"
said Mr. Weasley anxiously.
"It's like some sort of, I don't know, like some sort of rally," said Mr. Roberts. "They all seem to know each other, like a big party."
At that moment, a wizard in +4s appeared out of thin air next to Mr. Roberts's front door.
"Obliviate!"
he said sharply, pointing his wand at Mr. Roberts. Instantly, Mr. Roberts's eyes slid out of focus, his brows unknitted, and a look of dreamy unconcern fell over his face. Harry recognised the symptoms of one who had just had his memory modified.
"A map of the campsite for you,"
Mr. Roberts said placidly to Mr. Weasley, "and your change."
"Thanks very much," said Mr. Weasley.
The wizard in +4s accompanied them towards the gate to the campsite. He looked exhausted. His chin was blue with stubble, and there were deep purple shadows under his eyes. Once out of earshot of Mr. Roberts, he muttered to Mr. Weasley,
"Been having a lot of trouble with him. Needs a memory charm 10 times a day to keep him happy. And Ludo Bagman's not helping. Trotting around talking about bludgers and quaffles at the top of his voice. Not a worry about anti-Muggle security. Blimey, I'll be glad when this is over. See you later, Arthur."
He disapparated.
"I thought Mr. Bagman was head of magical games and sports," said Ginny, looking surprised. "He should know better than to talk about bludgers near Muggles, shouldn't he?"
"He should,"
said Mr. Weasley, smiling and leading them through the gates into the campsite. "But Ludo's always been a bit, well,
lax about security. You couldn't wish for a more enthusiastic head of the sports department, though. He played Quidditch for England himself, you know. He was the best beater the Wimborne Wasps ever had.
They trudged up the misty field between long rows of tents. Most looked almost ordinary. Their owners had clearly tried to make them as muggle-like as possible, but had slipped up by adding chimneys or bell-pulls or weather vanes. However, here and there was a tent so obviously magical that Harry could hardly be surprised that Mr. Roberts was getting suspicious. Halfway up the field stood an extravagant confection of striped silk, like a miniature palace, with several live peacocks tethered at the entrance. A little further on they passed a tent that had three floors and several turrets, and a short way beyond that was a tent which had a front garden attached, complete with birdbath, sundial, and fountain.
"Always the same," said Mr. Weasley, smiling. "We can't resist showing off when we get together. Ah, here we are. Look, this is us."
They had reached the very edge of the wood at the top of the field, and here was an empty space with a small sign hammered into the ground that read, "Weasley."
"Couldn't have a better spot," said Mr. Weasley happily. "The pitch is just on the other side of the wood there. We're as close as we could be."
He hoisted his backpack from his shoulders.
"Right," he said excitedly. "No magic allowed, strictly speaking, not when we're out in these numbers on Muggle land. We'll be putting these tents up by hand. Shouldn't be too difficult. Muggles do it all the time. Here, Harry, where do you reckon we should start?"
Harry had never been camping in his life. The Dursleys had never taken him on any kind of holiday, preferring to leave him with Mrs. Fig, an old neighbour. However, he and Hermione worked out where most of the poles and pegs should go, and though Mr. Weasley was more of a hindrance than a help, because he got thoroughly overexcited when it came to using the mallet, they finally managed to erect a pair of shabby two-man tents. All of them stood back to admire their handiwork. Nobody looking at these tents would guess they belonged to wizards, Harry thought. But the trouble was that once Bill, Charlie, and Percy arrived, they would be a party of 10. Hermione seemed to have spotted this problem too. She gave Harry a quizzical look as Mr. Weasley dropped to his hands and knees and entered the first tent.
"We'll be a bit cramped," he called, "but I think we'll all squeeze in. Come and have a look."
Harry bent down, ducked under the tent flap, and felt his jaw drop. He had walked into what looked like an old-fashioned, three-roomed flat, complete with bathroom and kitchen. Oddly enough, it was furnished in exactly the same sort of style as Mrs. Fig's. There were crocheted covers on the mismatched chairs, and a strong smell of cats.
"Well, it's not for long,"
said Mr. Weasley, mopping his bald patch with a handkerchief and peering in at the four bunk beds that stood in the bedroom.
"I borrowed this from Perkins at the office. Doesn't camp much any more, poor fellow. He's got lumbago."
He picked up the dusty kettle and peered inside it.
"We'll need water."
"There's a tap marked on this map the Muggle gave us," said Ron, who had followed Harry inside the tent and seemed completely unimpressed by its extraordinary inner proportions. "It's on the other side of the field."
"Well, why don't you, Harry and Hermione, go and get us some water, then?"
Mr. Weasley handed over the kettle and a couple of saucepans,
"and the rest of us will get some wood for a fire."
"But we've got an oven," said Ron.
"Why can't we just—" "Ron, anti-Muggle security," said Mr. Weasley, his face shining with anticipation. "When real Muggles camp, they cook on fires outdoors. I've seen them at it."
After a quick tour of the girls' tent, which was slightly smaller than the boys', though without the smell of cats, Harry, Ron, and Hermione set off across the campsite with the kettle and saucepans. Now, with the sun newly risen and the mist lifting, they could see the city of tents that stretched in every direction. They made their way slowly through the rows, staring eagerly around. It was only just dawning on Harry how many witches and wizards there must be in the world. He had never really thought much about those in other countries. Their fellow campers were starting to wake up. First to stir were the families with small children. Harry had never seen witches and wizards this young before. A tiny boy, no older than 2, was crouched outside a large pyramid-shaped tent, holding a wand and poking happily at a slug in the grass, which was swelling slowly to the size of a salami. As they drew level with him, his mother came hurrying out of the tent.
"How many times, Kevin, you don't touch Daddy's wand! Yuck!"
She had trodden on the giant slug, which burst. Her scolding carried after them on the still air, mingling with the little boy's yells,
"You bust slug! You bust slug!"
A short way further on, they saw 2 little witches, barely older than Kevin, who were riding toy broomsticks, which rose only high enough for the girl's toes to skim the dewy grass. A ministry wizard had already spotted them. As he hurried past Harry, Ron, and Hermione, he muttered distractedly, "In broad daylight! Parents having a lie-in, I suppose." Here and there, adult wizards and witches were emerging from their tents and starting to cook breakfast. Some, with furtive looks around them, conjured fires with their wands. Others were striking matches with dubious looks on their faces, as though sure this couldn't work. 3 African wizards sat in serious conversation, all of them wearing long white robes, and roasting what looked like a rabbit on a bright purple fire, while a group of middle-aged American witches sat gossiping happily beneath a spangled banner stretched between their tents, which read, "The Salem Witches Institute." Harry caught snatches of conversation in strange languages from the inside of tents they passed, and though he couldn't understand a single word, the tone of every single voice was excited.
"Is it my eyes, or has everything gone green?" said Ron.
It wasn't just Ron's eyes. They had walked into a patch of tents that were all covered with a thick growth of shamrocks, so that it looked as though small, oddly shaped hillocks had sprouted out of the earth. Grinning faces could be seen under those which had their flaps open. Then, from behind them, they heard their names.
"Harry! Ron! Hermione!"
It was Seamus Finnegan, their fellow Gryffindor fourth year. He was sitting in front of his own shamrock-covered tent with a sandy-haired woman who had to be his mother, and his best friend, Dean Thomas, also of Gryffindor.
"Like the decorations?"
said Seamus, grinning, when Harry, Ron and Hermione had gone over to say hello.
"The ministry's not too happy."
"Why shouldn't we show our collars?" said Mrs. Finnegan.
"You should see what the Bulgarians have got dangling all over their tents. You'll be supporting Ireland, of course," she added, eyeing Harry, Ron and Hermione beadily.
When they had assured her that they were indeed supporting Ireland, they set off again, though, as Ron said, "like we'd say anything else surrounded by that lot."
"I wonder what the Bulgarians have got dangling all over their tents," said Hermione.
"Let's go and have a look," said Harry, pointing to a large patch of tents upfield, where the Bulgarian flag, red, green and white, was fluttering in the breeze. The tents here had not been bedecked with plant life, but each and every one of them had the same poster attached to it, a poster of a very surly face with heavy black eyebrows. The picture was, of course, moving, but all it did was blink and scowl.
"Crumb," said Ron quietly.
"What?"
said Hermione.
"Crumb," said Ron. "Victor Crumb, the Bulgarian seeker."
"He looks really grumpy," said Hermione, looking around at the many crumbs blinking and scowling at them.
"Really grumpy?" Ron raised his eyes to the heavens. "Who cares what he looks like? He's unbelievable. He's really young, too, only just 18 or something. He's a genius. You wait until tonight, you'll see."